Leaked audio from Israel's former chief of military intelligence captures him saying the quiet part out loud. "50,000 dead in Gaza is necessary. They need a Nakba." This statement forces us to confront the line between warfare, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. Omer Bartov, one of the world's foremost genocide scholars, dismantles the talking points used to deny what's happening in Gaza. If Gaza's a genocide, what about the RAF bombing 600,000 Germans in World War II? What about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? He explains why those comparisons collapse and how ethnic cleansing so often slides into genocide. We also tackle an IDF Major General's admission that every missile and bomb Israel drops comes directly from Washington, raising the uncomfortable question, is the U.S. complicit in genocide or an active partner? And lastly, we explore the politics of Holocaust memory, Zionism's dark turn, and the paradox of a state born from genocide, now accused of committing one. Is Zionism salvageable, or has Israel already spent the last of its moral capital? This is part two of my conversation with Professor Omer Bartov. If you missed part one, you can go back and check it out right here on the Zach Show channel, where we laid the groundwork for part two that you won't want to miss. Without further ado, let's get into part two with Omer Bartov. Have you seen the leaked audio from a couple days ago at the Israeli ex-military chief saying 50,000 Gaza deaths were necessary?
Yeah, you know what is interesting about that? So this General Khalifa, who was head of intelligence, and of course who screwed up big time on October 7th, and eventually resigned because of that. I mean, to his credit, unlike Netanyahu, who will never resign and who carries the major responsibility, this guy resigned. He was also known as a more sort of liberal, left-leaning general.
Yeah.
Now, it turns out that this liberal, left-leaning general said that for every Israeli civilians who was killed on October 7th, at least 50 Palestinians should die. And that 50,000 dead is a reasonable price to pay. If you have this kind of genocidal thinking with this general, who, as I say, I mean, he's secular.
That's liberal with numbers, for sure.
Exactly.
that's about the only thing that's liberal about. Yeah, I've heard people say that, like, the U.S. equivalent to this guy would be someone who's a moderate, someone like kind of in the middle, but maybe a little bit to the left if you transferred him into U.S. politics.
Yeah, it would be like one of Biden's advisors. But again, I mean, if you transfer that to American politics, President Biden could have put an end to all this in November or December 23, and he didn't. So the Democrats ended up in the U.S. like the so-called left in Israel. But what is important about this particular general, Khalifa, is that he reflects the fact that although a majority of Israelis today clearly want the war to end, they don't like this war, they want the hostages back, there's still 20, apparently 20 living hostages there. They're fed up with, you know, all this reserve service and the destruction of the Israeli economy, all of that. And yet, if you ask them, are you in favor of ethnic cleansing? A majority of them are.
Mm.
They don't care about the Palestinians. So the problem is that Netanyahu, although he does not have a majority support in Israel, much of what he's doing in Gaza is supported by Israelis as long as they can have the hostages back. If he could move the Palestinians out, nobody would complain about that in Israel.
Yeah. I actually have the recording with the translation of the Israel ex-military chief. What did you say his name was?
Khalifa.
So yeah, I'm going to play that, and then let me know when you can see something come up for you on the screen. Do you see anything?
Yeah.
Okay, you see that? All right. I'm going to speak to translate it just for people who are only listening to this so they could actually hear what it says. So I'm just going to play this video. It says, statements by Israeli senior commanders expose a deliberate policy of destruction. So the fact that 50,000 have already been killed in Gaza is crucial for future generations. Okay, you humiliated, slaughtered, murdered. It's all true. The price, I said before the war, for everything that happened on the 7th of October, for one person on 7th of October, 50 Palestinians have to die. Never mind if they're children, I'm not speaking out of revenge, I'm speaking as a message for future generations. And then that last part was, that went quick, let me just go.
They need a Nakba.
Yeah, that's how it is, they need a Nakba from time to time to feel the price. So for people that aren't familiar with what the Nakba was or is, when people talk about that, what is that a symbol of?
So the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, first of all, was the expulsion of the majority of the Palestinian population from what became the State of Israel in the war of 1948. So about 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from what became the State of Israel, which was mm-hmm. bigger than what was offered in the partition resolution by the UN. And many Palestinians will say that the Nakba is not only that event of the expulsion, which destroyed Palestinian civilization in what became the State of Israel. Between 400 and 500 villages were then leveled, and forests were planted over them, or kibbutzim or other towns were built over them. But also, many Palestinians would say the Nakba is ongoing in the sense that Palestinians became refugees. In 1967, Israel took over the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, in which many of those people who had been expelled in 1948 were living. And they have been under Israeli occupation ever since. So for most of the existence of the State of Israel, Israel has occupied millions of Palestinians. And when the IDF operation began in Gaza after October 7th, there were many people who said, okay, now we are going to have the Gaza Nakba. And so not only in Palestinian minds, but in Israeli minds, many Israeli minds, the idea was, well, the first Nakba didn't quite finish the job. It was an interesting mechanism because on the one hand, the Nakba was denied in Israel. Nothing like that happened. And on the other hand, the job was not finished. So you can live in a kind of two realities. You deny that it happened, and then you also say, but it should have been done to the fullest extent because there are now 2 million Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. They are the descendants of 150,000 Palestinians that remained in Israel in 1948.
Yeah.
And now here was the opportunity to carry out another Nakba, and Palestinians see that precisely as such. In Gaza, and of course, increasingly also in the West Bank, ultimately the sort of conceptual aspect of this is that many in Israel would like to have all the land without the people, all the land for the Jews without the Palestinians. Yeah. One has to say, to be fair, that there is a mirror image here. The far right in Israel, which speaks about that openly, is very similar to the Hamas. Hamas is a fundamentalist organization. It's based on a charter from 1988, and that charter calls for the creation of an Islamic State over so-called historic Palestine, which is mandatory Palestine. So it would be an Islamic state ruled by Arabs with as few Jews as possible. And people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who are the far-right ministers in Netanyahu's cabinet, call for the creation of a halachic state, that is a Jewish religious state, over that same territory in which there would be mostly Jews and very few Palestinians. These two radical ideologies reflect each other, mirror each other, and in many ways, they feed on each other. Because for Netanyahu, having Hamas was always a good thing. Before October 7th, he liked having Hamas. He supported them. He arranged for Qatar to provide the money, which he handed over in money bags, because then he could say, well, these guys are crazy. We can't reach any agreement with them. So we just have to manage them. And in that sense, you know, these sort of extremists who don't reflect, I think, who don't represent the majority of either the Palestinians or the Jews in that land, control speech precisely because you have people like Khalifa, precisely because you have people who are supposed to be moderate, but who are not, and who, when he says that we have to do a Nakba every once in a while, what he is saying is that there is no political alternative.
Yeah, he's definitely not saying that in English, for sure. I wanted to get into some of the most common arguments that I hear people say when they bring up the fact that there is no genocide going on in Gaza, because often I hear these written about or spoken about unanswered, kind of in a vacuum. So I wanted to pose some of these to you to get your response. So the most common one that I hear for there being no genocide in Gaza is that the IDF no doubt is committing horrific war crimes, shooting children, killing journalists. It might even be systemic, but most Palestinian deaths come from Hamas using human shields or just as a byproduct of urban warfare, like high civilian casualties. Israel gives warnings to civilians. What would be your response to someone posing that argument?
Yeah, and you know, just the other day, Netanyahu was interviewed, and he said, if Israel wanted to carry out genocide, it could do it in an afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of people would also cite that as an argument. They would say, if Israel has the firepower to kill 80% of Gazans in days or weeks, why haven't they to this point?
Or drop an atom bomb, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, first of all, the mere idea that you say, well, you know, 50,000, 60,000, maybe 100,000, maybe 3% or 5% of the population and starving the rest of them, that doesn't a genocide make. If it were 500,000, maybe a million, okay, then we can talk about genocide. So the mere pattern of thinking like that, right? That's, by the way, like Khalifa, for him, 50,000, that's pretty reasonable. If you said to him, but that's genocidal thinking, he'd be appalled. Of course not. He's not in favor of genocide. It's just 50,000 people, and none of them belong to his family or friends, right? So the mere way of thinking is bizarre, but also it reflects a complete misunderstanding of what genocide is about. That's what we talked about. That is, genocide does not mean that you have to kill a majority of the people. It means that your goal is to destroy the group as such. And you can do it in various ways. You can kill members of the group, right? You can cause harm to members of the group. You can create conditions that would make life impossible for members of the group. You can restrict births in the group. All of those things are genocidal actions, but you don't have to show that you killed 30% or 40% or 50%. That's a complete misunderstanding of what genocide is about. There is an argument, which is sort of in part of what you were alluding to, that it's all because Hamas is using the population as human shields, right? And in Israel, it's very common to say, well, yes, it's terrible that they're dying, but it's not our fault. It's Hamas's fault. All these poor children who have died, by now 19,000 children. And again, it's a conservative estimate. That's not our fault. That's Hamas's fault, right? So we killed them, but it's not our fault that we killed them, right? Because it's Hamas. So the logic behind that is that you are saying that if you are fighting an organization that is built in a very small territory, which is very densely populated, and you decide to destroy that group, that organization, the only way you can do it is through genocide. The only way you can do it is to do to it what you claim it did, or at least planned to do to you, right? Hamas tried to do genocide on Israel, not that it was capable of it. Obviously, it's no match to the IDF, but let's say it tried. The only way you can destroy them, that organization, is through mass killing, and it's not your fault.
Yeah.
It's their fault.
Yeah. In response to the Hamas using human shields and hiding inside schools, this isn't my original idea. I've heard other people say this, and I think it's an apt comparison, is that let's say you have a school inside a densely populated city. I'm in Brooklyn right now, in New York City. Let's say that down the block there was, God forbid, a school shooter came inside the school and just started shooting kids. It doesn't matter how many kids that shooter killed or how many hostages he took to protect himself. The police would never drop a bomb on the school as a solution. I don't know what the solution would be, but they would figure out something to go in and strategically do what they had to do, even though the numbers of deaths would climb as they were strategizing. They would never say, like, all right, like, let's just drop a bomb on the entire thing.
Right. So there are two aspects to this. One is the situation you describe, if it happens in war, could be a war crime. That is, and that happened multiple times in Gaza now. So you have a school in which there are several hundred people. They're there because they're using it as a shelter, because you displaced them from their homes as an army, and you told them, go to that school because your homes are no longer safe. We are fighting there. So you put them there. Let's say there are 200 people there, men, women, children, old people. And now you identify, or you believe, that under that school there's a tunnel. And in that tunnel, there are two or three or five Hamas militants.
Mm.
Now, what do you do? If you take a 2,000-pound bomb and you drop it on the school on the assumption that it's big enough to go all the way down and kill those militants in the tunnel under the school, that would be disproportionate use of munitions and could easily be considered a war crime, because you know that you're going to kill large numbers of civilians. If you do that as part of a pattern, and your overriding intent in everything that you are doing is not simply to kill Hamas, to destroy Hamas. Your overriding intent, as you had expressed it before in many other contexts, is to destroy the group as such, then this would not only be a war crime and would not only be a crime against humanity, because you're killing large numbers of civilians, you're exterminating civilians, but would also become part of a genocidal pattern.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's apt to compare that to what obviously the U.S. Air Force would not be called in to bomb a school in which there is a shooter. You wouldn't bring in an F-15 or an F-35 to bomb a school with all the children in it. But that's not a war situation. In a war situation, you might, and there are, even in laws of war, you have to take into account that there may be civilian casualties. The question is of proportionality. Mm. That is, how many are you willing to take? And we know, because now it's all come out, the IDF uses, the Israeli Air Force uses all kinds of calculations of that sort. So if you identify some commander of Hamas and you want to take them out, how many people can die, innocent bystanders? How many do you allow yourself to assume could die? And they change that from 5 or 10 or 6 to 20, 30, up to 100.
Yeah.
Which explains why at the beginning, certainly at the beginning, with the massive bombings, bombing those Hamas leaders in their homes, where it was easier to hit them, right?
Yeah.
Not in the tunnels, when they came home, and they live in apartment blocks.
Yeah.
That explains why the number of civilians killed was so high.
I mean, yeah, by that logic, if you want to take out 5 Hamas insurgents, that allows you 500 civilians of bandits to take out. That's crazy. There's another set of atrocities that people often reference in tandem when they're, talking about the situation in Gaza not being a full-blown genocide. And so one of those is the RAF and U.S. Air Force bombings of the Germans in World War II, where they bombed 600,000 Germans, and the U.S. dropping the atomic bombs on Japan, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, killing 120,000 Japanese people instantly. People will say that we don't consider either of these genocides war crimes, possibly in retrospect, but not genocides. What would your response to that argument be?
Yeah, I'll answer that. But I'm just always curious about these kind of whataboutisms. When does this come up? When do people suddenly remember those things when they have to get off the hook for another set of crimes?
Yeah. I think people also look at the numbers too. Like they'll say, and if you're taking numbers completely out of context and you're just comparing two atrocities as a numbers game, which, you know, we spent the first 50 minutes of this conversation fleshing out all the context of genocide.
Right.
But if you're just someone who, like, on ChatGPT goes, 60,000 people dead in Gaza, find me another atrocity where more people died, but it's not considered a genocide. And then it just, like, gives you a list of all these things. I think that's more of, like, the numerical line of thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm a historian, so you know I actually look at the context.
Yeah.
So specifically on this case, say it is true the RAF and the U.S. Air Force, in part because they couldn't bomb accurately at the time, and in part because they had a theory which was proven wrong, as it often does, that if they bombed civilians in Germany, civilians would rise up and topple the regime, which is usually an error. They bombed German cities, open German cities. They firebombed them, horrific firebombing of Hamburg, of Lübeck, of Dresden, of course, and they killed about 600,000 civilians. Had the Allies not been the victors, and had there been a trial that they were not running, they might well have been facing war crimes allegations. Now, why is that not a genocide? All you have to think is what happened with the Americans and the British occupied Germany. What did they do?
Mm.
They announced a Marshall Plan. Not the British, because they were bankrupt, but the Americans.
Yeah, to rebuild.
The Marshall Plan, to rebuild Germany. Why did they rebuild Germany? Well, they had political reasons, of course, because having, you could say, well, the Germans carried out a genocide and more than one genocide in World War II, so why don't we do genocide on the Germans? And there was a few voices that suggested, let's make Germany into an agricultural country, which have meant the death of tens of millions of people. But that's not the voices that won out. The voices that won out said, first of all, we want a different Germany. We can have a different Germany if we create the conditions for a different kind of regime there. And they're also afraid of communism. So they thought that if Germany became a democratic state, it would become part of the West. It would become part of their alliance. standing against the Soviet Union, which took over all of Eastern Europe and Eastern Germany. And indeed, European leaders, Churchill and Roosevelt in particular, often said in their speeches, we are not fighting the German people, we are fighting the Nazi regime. The Americans did the same in Japan, although there was far more racism in the United States against the Japanese than the Germans in World War II, quite appalling racism. But when they came to occupy Japan, they actually helped Japan create a democracy and have benefited from it ever since. Now, had Israel said what would have been perfectly reasonable to do, had Israel said, Hamas attacked us. Hamas is an abysmal organization. It's bad for us and it's bad for Palestinians. It's oppressive. It's violent. It executes people. It demeans women. So if they said to the Palestinian population in Gaza, you help us destroy Hamas, and when we are done with them, because it'll be much easier for us to destroy them if you help us, we will help you create a different country for yourselves in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Help us do that. There will be people will be killed. Of course, it'll be a war. But at the end of that, we will help you create something that would be better for you and better for us. And will not allow such extremist organizations as Hamas to raise their heads again. But that is the nightmare of the Israeli government. The Israeli government, the reason they don't give a day a sort of day after scenario, the reason Netanyahu will not say what he wants to see after is that the only logical ruler for Gaza after the war, which is no longer a war, is the Palestinian Authority. That means a unification of Gaza and the West Bank and the possibility of political negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel. They don't want that. So in that sense, there's a huge difference between the two, despite the fact that, of course, killing so many hundreds of thousands of German and Japanese civilians could have been seen as a war crime.
Yeah. Yeah. Rebuilding Gaza for Gazans doesn't seem to be in the cards right now, unless someone's saying it in Hebrew, and I'm just not understanding it. There's another genocide expert I saw came out recently to say that there is a genocide occurring in Gaza, William Shabas. He tends to focus on the legal side of genocide. And I thought that was interesting because in the past, he has had a definition of genocide that focuses on the biologics, like the physical deaths. And in the past, he has said that the requirement that the perpetrator act with intent to destroy a protected group in whole or in part means that the word destroy must be taken in its material sense, physical or biological destruction, and not cultural destruction. And a lot of what we've been speaking about is the dissolution of culture, but also the massive amounts of deaths, not purely the biological destruction. As a genocide expert yourself, what do you think would compel a guy like William Shabas, who has stuck to that biological requirement in the past, which is something like you saw in the Holocaust, where 63% of Jews being killed in Gaza at this moment, it's around 3%. What do you think his reasoning could be behind declaring what's happening right now in Gaza as a genocide, even though it contradicts his definitions in the past?
Look, I mean, I can't speak for Bill Shabas. I spoke with him. We met in June in a conference on genocide, and we spoke at length about this, and his position on Gaza was formed in 2014. And by 2025, he was saying that this was absolutely a genocide. So I can't say exactly why he changed his position. And you would have to ask him whether he actually believes that he changed it or not. But the way I can understand it is that what you see happening in Gaza is not only killing large numbers of people, and I expect that whenever this ends, the numbers are going to be very high, but also that you are destroying lives on an unprecedented, certainly for the 21st century, to an unprecedented extent. If you think that, if you remember that in Gaza, half of the population are under 18, and you think what happens to all those young people, boys and girls, babies, toddlers, who have been deeply traumatized by the horrific killing that is going on there, by the bombing, and they have been deprived of food, even if they don't die of hunger, that will be stunted for the rest of their lives. If you think of these sort of horrors, we talked before about women who are suffering terribly from this, about the chronically ill who cannot get any hospital treatment. We have no clear count of how many of them died indirectly. So there is the physical toll and the mental toll on this population is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And to speak about it in these kind of terms, well, it's only 60,000 people, is itself a kind of really inexplicable cynicism, but it also doesn't reflect what is actually happening there. The people are living, no one gets to drink clean water. People are just living in absolutely abysmal conditions. And the long-term effects of that, even if, which I don't know how, but even if this group will be able to reconstitute itself somehow in Gaza, the price for generations would be absolutely incalculable. So I suspect that Shabbos, who is conservative in his views on defining genocide, has been exposed to a great deal of that, and felt that you could not call it anything else. And the last thing I think that I believe has influenced his thinking is what I said before, within legal thinking. And he's an expert in international law.
Yeah, he's a legal guy.
He's a legal guy. He meets Philip Sands in The Hague. You know, they argue before the ICJ and ICC. I think another element that must have swayed him is the fact that there is no longer any other explanation for what Israel is doing in Gaza. You could say at the beginning, Israel has a right of self-defense. It's fighting a war in urban warfare, in built-up areas. There are human shields. You could come up with all kinds of arguments that would at least contextualize the amount of people dying. Now you can't do any of that. It's simply impossible. There is no other explanation but that one.
Yeah. You mentioned before the U.S. complicity in what's going on in Gaza right now. I don't know. Have you seen Mehdi Hassan's article that came out this week in The Guardian about the U.S. being a partner in genocide?
Haven't read it yet, no.
I want to read you an excerpt to get your thoughts on it. So he writes, as retired Israeli Major General Yitzhak Brick acknowledged in November 23, all of our missiles, the ammunition, precision-guided bombs, all the airplanes and bombs, it's all from the U.S. The minute they turn off the tap, you can't keep fighting, you being Israel.
Sure.
You have no capability. Everyone understands that we can't fight this war without the United States, period. And then Hassan writes, in fact, given Brick's assessment, I would argue that we have witnessed in Gaza from the U.S. government is worse than complicity. It is an active participation in an ongoing genocide. Would you go as far to say that the U.S. is an active partner in the genocide in Gaza?
Look, everything he says is correct, and I've been saying it for a long time now, because, as I said, President Biden in November or December 2023 could have said to Netanyahu, you know what? You have 2 weeks to wrap this up, do what you want. And after that, if you don't stop, you're on your own. And within 2 to 3 weeks, the IDF would have stopped. Because it cannot operate without constant supply of munitions from the U.S., shells, tank shells, but also interceptor rockets. It cannot operate. First of all. But secondly, of course, because the United States is giving a diplomatic cover. The Security Council would have, had the United States changed its policy, would have ordered Israel to stop. And had Israel not stopped, even as Netanyahu said at the time, he said, we will fight with our fingernails or whatever. He tried to sound Churchillian, but that's nonsense. But even had Israel tried to continue the fight without these supplies, the Security Council would have ordered Israel to stop at the price of economic sanctions and a military embargo.
Yeah.
And that's it. Yeah. That's the end of it. Israel is not Russia. That's the difference. So, yes, it's true. Now, certainly the U.S. is complicit, and certainly the U.S. is facilitating what Israel is doing. And it's not only the U.S. It's also Germany. It's also Britain. It's also France. So Germany now finally said, well, we won't supply them with munitions that are clearly going to be used in Gaza. That's a kind of, it's not clear exactly what it means, and it's not clear whether it means in the future, if we have contracts now, are we still going to fulfill those contracts? We don't know exactly. They're all hedging.
No.
I would say the United States, first of all, because at least Germany is not a permanent member of the Security Council, so it doesn't have veto power, which France and Britain do. But they're not only complicit, they are facilitating it. They are helping Israel do that. There are British spy planes flying constantly over Gaza from Cyprus. They're all facilitating it. Whether they are active participants, that gets to be a little mushier, I'd say, but it comes close to it.
Yeah, facilitating is a good word. I like that because we may not be the ones dunking the genocide ball through the net, but we're definitely the point guard bringing it up the court and setting up the play. You know, Israel wouldn't be able to finish the alley-oop if the U.S. wasn't Chris Paul bringing the ball up the court.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you this as we start to end off. I grew up with a lot of Jewish friends. My dad is Jewish. I was raised Catholic, but I grew up in a household where we celebrated both. And I've been thinking a lot about like the backlash that Jews around the world will have in the future because of Israel's actions with the whiplash of public opinion of Jews. Do you think that Israel is quote unquote spending the Holocaust card, like the moral capital that Jews gained after World War II with this genocide in Gaza and leaving future generations of Jews out to dry, essentially, with nothing but backlash? Because like Gen Z and below, like when they hear the word Jew in school, they're not going to think of Jews in concentration camps. They're going to think of starving Gazans and, you know, the West Bank and like the bombs. Like they're not going to think immediately of the Holocaust like generations before.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is what I wrote about in the Times, right? Exactly. But you take it a step further. So, first of all, I think that Israel won't be able to draw any longer on this credit, so to speak, of the Holocaust, and it did it for a long time. It presented itself to the world, and I think it saw itself as the sort of the answer to the Holocaust, as a country that would be a safe haven for the Jews. It received international recognition for that reason, because people said, look what happened to the Jews, where they didn't have a state and there was no one to protect them. It was supposed to be a place that would solve the issue of anti-Semitism and of Jewish persecution. It would be, Jews would be on their own. They take care of themselves. Of course, it's become the least safe place for Jews in the world rather than the safest. And it's become now an incredibly violent society, violent vis-a-vis Palestinians, also violent internally. So I think, as you say, first of all, Israel won't be able to draw on this credit any longer. And that, for Israel as a country, is not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm.
That's what I was trying to write. It's not necessarily bad because people have said that already in the 1980s, that the way young Israelis have been brought up for generations is with this existential fear that any threat to them, even if it's a threat by the people they occupy and oppress, is immediately seen as an existential threat, as the first step toward Auschwitz. It completely clouds your thinking. It makes you violent, but also paranoid.
Yeah.
You're always thinking that you're about to be taken over by whom? By the people that you are, yourself are oppressing. It deforms your entire notion of what is ethical, what is moral. To be free of that is a good thing. Mm. Now, the stain of what Israel did will not go away. It will remain. And younger Israelis will have to pay for that, for these crimes that were committed in their name. But if you think about the international community, and if you think about Jews outside of Israel, yes, I think part of the problem is that Israel has always claimed to be the representative not only of its own citizens, but of Jews everywhere. And it didn't ask them whether they want to be represented. It just claimed that it represented them. And that can become, when the state is involved in such crimes as it is right now, can become very dangerous for those communities, because Jews are identified with the crimes of Israel, even if they oppose them. Or they have no opinion about them whatsoever. So I think that, and in the long run, what I think may well happen, because I don't see Israel being stopped. We talked about the license it's being given. Israel will become a full-blown apartheid state, an authoritarian state, and it will become a pariah state.
Yeah.
It'll also be a main cause for the rise of anti-Semitism, real anti-Semitism, not the kind of allegations of anti-Semitism that were hurled at people who were demonstrating rightly against crimes by Israel. And I think that for Jewish communities around the world, it will become an embarrassment, and they will want to distance themselves from it as much as they can, because why would you want to be identified with a country that is such? What it's creating a huge rift within Jewish communities around the world. That's something that began before October 7th, also for reasons of theology and so forth, but it'll deepen it. And that too is a kind of sad outcome for what the project was supposed to have done at its inception.
Yeah, that tying of the Jewish identity to the Jewish state of Israel has always seemed super strange to me, because, you know, I grew up Catholic. I understand the Jewish identity because of a dual religious household. But like that would be me being raised Catholic and tied to the Vatican as a geopolitical state, and me feeling pressure to sign off on everything that Italy does geopolitically. Like when Italy attacked France, all Catholics would have to get behind Italy, and no matter what, we'd have to be like, yeah, Italy's in the right. Like, we support Italy. That's essentially like what goes on with diaspora Jews and Israel. Like, there's this involuntary pressure from the higher ups in Israel, and I'm sure a lot of it is just like generational pressure to sign off on whatever Israel does as a state, even though you may not agree with it. So I think along the same lines, like, is it time for Jews to Jews worldwide to separate their identity from the state of Israel and like reclaim Jewishness without being bound to Israel foreign policy? Because that seems like such a strange buy-in for a religious mm-hmm. faith. Is like, not only do I have to buy into the Old Testament, but I have to like sign off on the geopolitical decisions.
Yeah, look, I mean, I just say, Italy is no longer ruled by the Vatican. So, I mean,
back in the day. Yeah, yeah.
Was once a state and now it's not. Yes, I think some of this is happening, but I think it's happening in a sort of much more traumatizing manner now. That Israel is playing a major role instead of in unifying Jewish communities around the world, and Jews are a minority in all other countries, but in Israel, and even in Israel itself, Jews are only half of the population. People forget that. There's 7 million Jews and 7 million Palestinians there. So it's playing a role in dividing the Jewish community in the world rather than in unifying it, which was the idea once of some of the early Zionists. I think it can work the other way. I think it's possible that Jews around the world, certainly American Jews, will understand that if they want Israel to change, Israel does not have the wherewithal to change from within right now. It can only be changed by pressure from outside. There are positive forces in Israel. There are creative forces. There are a lot of brave people in Israel who are opposing that, but they have no space in which to develop right now. They need pressure from the outside, and the most effective pressure can come from Jewish communities, certainly in this country. So if they care about their country, and I can understand that. I care about it. I grew up there. You know, I see myself as an Israeli and not only as an American citizen. Then they can work for that. Mm. But to work for that, not by protecting the kind of criminal leadership that Israel has now, but helping Israel by putting pressure on it to change and to realize that it must change the entire political paradigm that it's based on. And that could be rather than a split within the Jewish community, which is what Israel is leading to now, because the people, you know, the fanatic messianic religious factions in Israel now are such, they themselves want to separate themselves from anything that they don't even see as Jewish anymore. But if you want to create some kind of Jewish unity, the way to do it is through putting pressure on your own government, which is the most important government in terms of what happens in Israel, on the U.S. government, to change its policies vis-a-vis Israel, not simply to punish it, but rather to help it be rid of this kind of criminal clique that took over.
So you think the original Zionist dream, the one that's born of freedom and liberation, do you think that's salvageable with the correct pressure?
I don't know. I may not see it in my lifetime, because as I said, I mean, the more likely option is that Israel will become a pariah state, but it won't be able to exist as such.
Yeah.
It won't exist for long. And then what will happen? Who knows? We can see what happened to South Africa. It will implode.
Yeah.
And then you still need to look into the future. I may not see that future, but I think it's a possibility. And, you know, I wrote a book about this that's coming out, and it does try to think about how did Zionism become what it became, because it didn't start off like that. It started off as a movement of liberation, of emancipation, of appeal to humanitarianism, and it became a state ideology of oppression, of expansionism, of militarism, and now quite racist. So it had that potential in it. But there are other potentials in Israel. What people don't understand is that Israel now has become a much more Middle Eastern state than it ever was before, that there is a huge overlap between what is called Israeli culture and Palestinian culture on both sides, that you can actually create a much more interesting and much more varied and diverse society in Israel than exists now. That the similarities between the cultures are quite extraordinary, and you can work in that direction, but not with the people who've taken over politics and ideology in Israel now. And those ideas can be helped by Jewish communities around the world. I also think that Germany can play an important role in this, because Germany is one country that knows something about how you come out of a catastrophe and create a different culture. But one has to be optimistic. And in the short run, I can't say that I am.
If Israel continues on this path with the bombings, the killings, continuing to make Gaza unlivable, what does the future look like, not just for Palestinians, but for Israel itself?
So this is an important point, because I think while the most terrible thing is, of course, what Israel is doing in Gaza and in the West Bank increasingly, and that's sort of under the radar now because of the horrors in Gaza, that is also changing Israeli society itself very rapidly. There's an erosion of the legal system. The police has become very violent, and it's really now a militia under this fascist Ben-Gvir. The chance of a democratic election, of the election being democratic, is being eroded. Israel is in permanent constitutional crisis. The attorney general has been fired illegally, and the whole thing is, and there is more and more violence against those who are opposed to this regime in Israel. And so it will become, if it's allowed to continue, a full-blown apartheid, not only in the West Bank and Gaza, but increasing violence vis-a-vis Palestinian citizens of Israel, and there's 2 million of them, increasing violence vis-a-vis opponents of the regime, increasing enforcement of religion and religious mores on Israel. Israel won, so to speak, the war against Iran, as people say in Israel, but the Ayatollahs are coming into Israel. It can change. And that would be a society that most of us would not want to be associated with. And as I say, whether it could exist like that in the long run, no, because it will lose. It presented itself for a long time as the so-called villa in the jungle. It was the only democracy in the Middle East. Well, it won't be a democracy. It talked about having the most moral army in the world, or even having some kind of ethics. It doesn't anymore at all. Its strongest allies, which are West European countries and the United States, will think twice. And if Israel loses all its privileges with the EU, with the United States, loses much of its elites. About 100,000 people have already left it, who are mostly professional, not necessarily for political reasons, just because they don't see a future for themselves and their children in that country. It will be a true, increasingly impoverished, pariah state. Yeah. That's the future.
Yeah.
And it's a very sad future that can be prevented, maybe still, but the chances are diminishing, and it's being helped to fall into that abyss by its own allies.
Mm. Well, Professor Omer Bartov, thank you so much. I truly appreciate your time. As you mentioned, you do have a book coming out next spring, I believe, called What Went Wrong. It's about the dark turn of Zionism. I'm sure we could have a whole nother conversation about that book. I look forward to it when it eventually comes out. I would love to do round two. For right now, where would you like people to check out your work? What's the best place to do that? Anything you'd like me to link to the conversation?
Well, there's one book that came out in 2022, just before everything happened. It's called Genocide, the Holocaust, and Israel-Palestine, First-Person History in Times of Crisis. So, and the new book that's coming out in April, Israel, What Went Wrong? I'd love people to pre-order it already. I'm looking at the proofs right now.
It's available for pre-order right now. People can go check it out. Well, I look forward to discussing that book as well. Thank you again, Professor Bartov. This has been an absolutely enlightening conversation on the conflict, and I know people will gain a ton of value from what you've said.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hey guys, if you like this clip, there's a lot more waiting for you. Join the Zach Show 2.0 to unlock the full video and audio version of this episode, plus bonus content you won't find anywhere else. Exclusive AMAs, the entire back catalog of premium episodes, and the ability to submit topics and questions for future shows. Subscribe today at thezachshow.supercast.com. I'll see you there.